Can I help you? The program is introduced by Marjorie Todd.
Good afternoon. Now, before I introduce our first speaker today, here's a timely bit of information from the Ministry of Transport. A good many drivers, and especially motorcyclists, it seems, have been going on and on driving on provisional licenses and have put off taking their driving tests. Well, as from April the 1st, the number of provisional licenses anyone can have may be limited to 7. Later on, the number may be reduced still further. But for the time being, the thing to note is that if you're already using your 7th provisional license, you'd better make arrangements to take a test right away. Now, in this program, we've already dealt with several aspects of the law of hire purchase. Today, we've another one. You've contracted to buy something on hire purchase, and later on, you find you can't go on with the payments. Well, what may happen? Here's Pamela Deeds to tell you about two recent court cases involving large sums of money. That's to say, cases outside the protection of the Hire Purchase Acts. Pamela Deeds.
Buying on hire purchase usually means signing an agreement which records the terms of the deal. Most people are alert to the price, the monthly instalments, and all that sort of thing. But there are other clauses in an agreement which few trouble to read. One of them usually says what's to happen if the purchaser falls behind with his payments, or if he wants to return the thing he's buying. Now, getting out of the deal can be expensive, very expensive. Why? Well, if you get a new car on hire purchase today, and the company take it back a few months later, what they get back is a second-hand car, worth a good deal less. The hire purchase company will want compensation from you. In the hope that this will cut out argument, the agreement usually provides when this compensation is to be payable and how it's to be calculated. Where the hire purchase price is £300 or less, the law puts an upper limit on the amount of compensation that can be claimed. But in deals over £300, it's entirely up to the parties. And in practice, this often means that the purchaser signs a form which commits him to much stiffer terms than he realizes. And when he defaults and is presented with a whacking big claim, he objects and often waits until he is taken to court. But having broken his agreement, obviously he can't win his case. The best he can hope is that the court will award the company less than it claimed from him. This is what happened in a case in the House of Lords recently. A man had bought a motor car on hire purchase for well over £300, so he wasn't protected by the Act. After only a month, he sent the car back and said he couldn't afford to go on. The company took the car back and then reminded him of a clause in the hire purchase agreement he had signed. That clause said that if at any time he ended his agreement, he'd have to make up his payments to 2/3 of the hire purchase price. The man argued that that was far more than the damage the company would suffer. And the House of Lords upheld him. It decided that the man was not bound by the 2/3 clause. But that did not mean that he could just send the car back and then pay no more. He is still liable to pay the company compensation for the loss it really suffered. Another man was even less lucky. There was a jukebox, hire purchase price over £800. After about 3 months, the hirer fell into arrears. The hire purchase company waited another 4 months and then took the jukebox back and sued the hirer under a clause in the agreement which said that for every month the agreement was in force, he would have to pay a certain sum in depreciation. So it would have paid this hirer to end the agreement as soon as ever he knew he couldn't keep up his payments. As it was, the depreciation cost him more than the rent would have done. But the court upheld the hire purchase company. The man had entered into the agreement, and he must stick to it. I'm afraid these cases show only too clearly that to make a mistake over a hire purchase can be very expensive. It pays to think several times before signing the agreement, to make quite sure, A, that the purchase is worth having, and B, that one can afford it. Still, even the most cautious sometimes come unstuck. If ever you should want to get out of a hire purchase agreement, at least benefit from the sad experience of the man with the car and the man with the jukebox. Get legal advice before you write any letters and before you fall into arrears. It may save you pounds.
Now, here's a letter from a listener who says, 4 years ago, a friend of mine was involved in an accident with a lorry. The driver of the lorry was found guilty of dangerous driving. My friend was advised to settle with the insurance company out of court for £800. Her injuries have proved more permanent and more serious than was thought at first. Can she go to court now over the compensation? She was very wrongly advised over this matter in the first place. Rupert Townsend Rose is going to give his answer to that letter. Rupert Townsend Rose.
I'm afraid there's no prospect now of reopening the settlement that was made. In a case like this of personal injury, any legal action has to be started within 3 years of the accident. And even if 3 years hadn't elapsed, we can be pretty certain that the insurance company wouldn't have paid the £800 except on condition that it finally disposed of any claim which the injured woman had. The letter says that she was badly advised. That may be so, but one can't be sure. Sometimes questions of contributory negligence arise, where the injured party was to some extent to blame for what happened. Sometimes there's difficulty in proving the case against the person who was at fault. A settlement out of court is often worthwhile in circumstances like these, though possibly they didn't arise in the case I'm dealing with because the lorry driver concerned was found guilty of dangerous driving. We're told that the injuries are more serious than was thought at the time the case was settled. It's quite possible that 3 or 4 years ago no one could have foreseen this development, and that £800 looked a very good settlement. The insurance company wouldn't have paid out more than was justified, and there would have been no point in fighting a legal battle unless there were reasonable prospects of recovering more than the £800. In an action for damages, it's not unusual for the defendant, the person sued, to pay a sum of money into court. The plaintiff then has the choice of accepting this in full settlement or going on with the action in the hope of getting more. If he decides to carry on, and the judge awards him no more in damages than was paid in, he may be considerably out of pocket over legal costs, for he'll probably have to pay part of the defendant's costs as well as his own. You'll see that it requires good judgment to know how much to pay into court, and perhaps even better judgment to decide whether to take the money or fight on. I should add that the judge doesn't know that any money has been paid in, so he's not prejudiced against the defendant on this account. The position in Scotland is slightly different. Some listeners have asked about the basis on which damages are awarded in cases of personal injury and to what extent they vary in amount. The object is to recompense the injured party, so far as money can do that, for the loss and suffering sustained. Even £100,000 in damages wouldn't really compensate us for the loss of our eyesight. But if someone is injured, there's little the law can do to compensate him except award a sum of money, payable by the person legally liable for what happened. The amounts vary enormously, from a few pounds to sums very occasionally as high as £40,000 or £50,000. It depends upon the extent of the injury and its effect upon the victim. The loss of a leg would be a serious enough matter for anyone, but much more so for a professional footballer than for a bank clerk. This is taken into account in assessing damages. In such a case, what are known as general damages would be payable for the suffering and disablement resulting from the loss of the leg, and would include compensation for loss of future earnings. In addition, special damages would take account of out-of-pocket items, like medical expenses or the cost of employing someone to look after a business while the owner was recovering. The courts try to avoid wide variations in damages where the circumstances are similar. A solicitor has records of the various awards that are made, and the medical evidence in any case he's dealing with gives him a pretty good idea of the right figure for damages. He also knows what difficulties are in the way of proving his client's case. And you must bear in mind that it's usually necessary to prove not only the fact of injury, but also the negligence of the person who caused it. Knowing then the likely damages and any difficulties the case presents, the solicitor is able to advise whether a proposed settlement out of court is worth making.
And here's a quite different sort of legal problem. Can a publican refuse to serve you? Guy Naylor.
Listeners have written indignant letters about publicans refusing to serve customers. Some of the problems they raise are these. Can a licensee refuse for no reason whatever? If a licensee refuses, is there any legal remedy open to the customer, apart from writing to the brewery concerned? Can the magistrates do anything? If so, is a persistent and unreasonable refusal enough? Well, I want to make it clear that there's all the difference in the world between what's popularly known as a public house and what is known as an inn, according to the law. The word inn is sometimes used in a sentimental way to describe a country pub, but in law the word inn applies only to hotels which come within the definition of the Hotel Proprietors Act 1956, Section 1. That's to say, a hotel where the proprietor offers food, drink, and if so required, sleeping accommodation, to any traveller who appears able and willing to pay a reasonable sum and who's in a fit state to be received. Pubs are outside this classification. They may provide food as well as drink, but they don't provide sleeping accommodation. And I'm afraid the publicans have much greater power to refuse than these indignant listeners like to believe. The keeper of an inn, and this applies just as much to a temperance hotel as any other, is obliged to supply food, drink or lodging to travellers coming within the definition I've just given, provided he's got the necessary food, drink or bedroom space. The licensee of a public house, on the other hand, apart from any contract he may have with his brewers or anyone else, can close whenever he likes, though of course he can only be open for the sale of alcoholic drinks during permitted hours. Even if he is open, he has complete freedom, in law, as to whom he serves and whom he doesn't. By Act of Parliament, a licensee of a pub is required not to permit drunkenness or any violent, quarrelsome or riotous conduct on his premises, and he's liable to heavy fines if he does so, quite apart from the danger of losing his license. If he asks a person guilty of such conduct to go, and he doesn't, that person is liable to a £5 fine, or £2 in Scotland, and the publican can ask a constable to help throw him out. Even if a customer has done nothing objectionable, a publican can refuse to serve him and request him to leave. And if he won't go, the publican can use reasonable force to get him out. So there you are. As to giving a reason, of course he'd be a fool to do so, because of the risk of saying something slanderous, or of starting violent, quarrelsome or riotous conduct. I agree, if a publican refuses to serve you, other people may think there's something wrong about you. But I wouldn't advise you to start a defamation action on those grounds. Publicans don't usually refuse for no reason. I can't see anything to prevent licensees agreeing with licensees of other pubs to exclude a particular person or class, except, of course, that there may be a greater risk of libel or slander if they write or talk about it among themselves. Actually, they do sometimes exclude classes. An obvious example is the no coaches sign you sometimes see outside country pubs. The publicans concerned don't have anything against people on coaches. The explanation probably is that they simply haven't got the necessary accommodation, or that a big influx of people might disturb the regulars on whom their trade depends. As for the licensing authorities, they have complete discretion to refuse to renew a license, but they're bound to use this discretion according to law and not arbitrarily. The licensing acts certainly don't include persistent and unreasonable refusal to serve alcoholic drinks as a ground. You can write to the brewers, if that can be called a legal remedy, but you must remember that brewers choose their licensees, tenants or managers pretty carefully, and they'll listen to the other side of the story as well. I think the most sensible course is to go to a pub where they're glad to see you, and to bear in mind that the word public is a bit misleading. Public houses are perhaps a bit like public schools in this respect, except they're rather easier to get into, but more difficult to get thrown out of.
So it seems. I'd no idea there could be so many complications. And now for our last speaker, Edward Leader, on a few income tax problems. Edward Leader.
Before I get on to dealing with the particular queries I've chosen for today's talk, I'd like to make one point. It's this. Listeners frequently write to me, often in great detail, and ask me to check the correctness of their individual income tax demands. Now, I'm sorry, but I must make it clear that I can't undertake to furnish listeners with a personal income tax service. What I can do, however, is what I'm going to do this afternoon, namely, pick out from among the letters you've sent me those which, while initially posing a personal problem, raise points which are of general interest. So now, having got that off my chest, here's the first one. A lady writes from London, Northwest 1, saying that she gets a maintenance made under a magistrate's court order of £4.10 a week for herself and her two children. With this and her earnings, she gets into the range where she has to pay the standard rate of 7 and 9 pence in the pound on the top part of her total income. She says her bank manager has told her that she could apply to the court for a variation of the order so that her husband has to pay income tax on the £4.10 a week instead of herself. She says the courts say they've never heard of such an order, and that the Inland Revenue say that she must pay income tax on it. Now, of course, the income tax people are right on this. Money paid to a wife under a court order, whether it's maintenance under separation or alimony in divorce, is part of the wife's income. And it's added in with any other income she's got for the purpose of calculating her tax liability. Incidentally, too, and this answers a question for one or two other listeners, it's unearned income, not subject to earned income relief, except in the case of age allowance for people over 65 whose income doesn't exceed £800. So I can't offer any comfort to this lady. I've got to tell her that she must bring the allowance into calculation for her own tax liability. The next query asks whether a voluntary regular allowance to an unrelated friend in need ranks for income tax allowance. Now, in the case which we've just been talking about, the husband can get tax allowance on a compulsory payment made under a court order. But a purely voluntary allowance, such as this second listener makes, doesn't rank for relief unless the person paying it enters into a trust deed or covenant. Now, income tax on building society interest. Two listeners write in, one from Tynmouth and one from Kingstainton. Strange this, because they may come under the same tax office. They ask whether building society interest is, really and truly, receivable by them free of income tax. Well, provided the amount invested doesn't exceed £5,000, it really and truly is, no matter what other income you may have. If the total income is big enough to attract surtax, however, you'll have to pay surtax on the grossed-up amount. That's the amount which would have produced net, the sum you've drawn, if you had had to pay income tax on it at standard rate. Now, here's a point about occasional earnings. I've had several letters about this from time to time, and there seems to be a quite common impression that you pay income tax only on regular income, and that occasional, or what I frequently heard described as casual earnings, don't have to be returned for income tax. One listener, who's employed but who wrote an article for which he got paid, even invented a new phrase for the occasion. She said her writing was a paying hobby, and she didn't see why she had to pay income tax on it at all. All sorts of people get all sorts of odd earnings. In several cases which have come to my knowledge, people who've retired have been asked to go back to their old firms for, say, a fortnight or a month as holiday relief. Many people get the odd bit of commission on introducing business. Insurance business is quite a common example. I'm afraid I've got to make it clear, as the last point in this talk, that such earnings do have to be returned for income tax, and that subject to any allowances you may have, they will be taxed as earnings.